From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The legendary Carl Reiner returns to the show this week. He's a comedian, an author, an actor, a straight man to Mel Brooks, a second banana to Sid Caesar, director to Steve Martin, and the creator of your favorite sitcom of all time, The Dick Van Dyke Show. Carl Reiner's latest book is devoted to the story of that show. The book is called Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. Carl Reiner, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I love it because we're going to talk about something I love doing.
Yes, now I understand that you're going to write a memoir about things that happened to you since you wrote your last memoir.
Yes, yes.
But first, we'll talk about this book, about the Dick Van Dyke Show. I love this book. It's funny and it's touching. I especially like page 33, which has this photo of a cover of Look magazine with a picture of Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah, that's funny. We had to find that picture, and it's in the archives, Smithsonian or something. We couldn't find it, so that is a photocopied one of the Look magazine of that year. We stuck her figure in it.
Now, in your book, you talk about Rosemarie being sort of upset about that.
Yes, yeah, that was very true. Rosemarie and I had a problem the first year because she was told it was a program about three writers who write for a television show, and actually it's about three writers who write for a television show whose original thrust is in his home life at home, and somebody explained it to her wrong, and she was waiting for, you know, the activity took place in the 49 Bonnie Meadow Road, and so she had that in her craw, for she was always thinking she didn't have enough to do that first year. And then when it came that they used her Mary Tyler Moore's cover picture on the cover, she said to me, "Why do you always keep pushing me?" I said, and that this is absolutely true. The second year, when we were ready to get, she, by the way, Rosemarie, there's nobody better as an actress. I said to Rosemarie, "We have to meet at our agent's office," and I said, "Unless you can come to the realization that it's not me, but the world, the men in this world would prefer seeing," and I mentioned those three parts, her legs, her tits, and her ass. Actually, I use a much more ugly word for private parts, just to make sure she knew I was dead serious. I said, "If you can't accept that, has nothing to do with me. If you can't accept that, then we can't." And she accepted it, and for the next year, we were dear friends, and we remain so for 60 years.
Baby Rosemarie, she was a star when she was a little tiny girl.
She was a star at 4 years of age. I read her book. It's one of the saddest biographies you'll ever read. Her father was a monster. Her father managed her, and her mother and she lived, they were divorced. Her mother and she lived in a one-room apartment. One room was a bedroom, kitchen, toilet, everything in that one room. And her husband took the $80 she got each week for doing one little show when she was 4 years old, and lived in an absolutely, you know, nice home. Hmm. And it's one of the saddest things. That poor woman, she was a star at four. She had her picture on the Variety cover when she was six. She never stopped being, and her voice was the same at four as it was when she became an adult.
Right, she sang like Sophie Tucker when she was just a little tiny thing.
I know, and they're recording so you can't believe them.
Yeah, and well, it's interesting that you cast a woman as the writer, because I'm looking in your book, there's this wonderful picture of the writing staff of the Sid Caesar Show, and Mel Brooks has got that pipe in his pocket.
Right, but the truth of the matter is on the original on the original show of shows, there was a writer, Lucille Callan, and Mel Tolkien, two Canadians. They were members of Max Liebman's staff at Tamamit when they worked there. When he came to do the show of shows, he took both of them with him. And Lucille Callan was with us for a number of years until Sid and Imogene broke up, and Imogene went to have her own show on another network. And that's when Lucille went with Imogene, and that was the last we saw. But we wanted to... people, our new writing room with somebody who had the feminine view, and we had another woman writer. Selma Diamond was in the cast.
She was wonderful.
One of the writers, a very funny woman. And so that's why Rosemary was cast. We always had a woman's attitude in the office.
Well, you know, I was really loving in your new book, the Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show was born, Carl Renner. There's some scripts that you provided, a couple of scripts, and it's very illuminating to read the scripts and to see how you wrote for your cast rather than have your actors play to your writing. When you compare the two scripts, one is for Head of the Family and the other for the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah, that was a very interesting part of my life. I had just finished doing the shows, and the review format was persona non grata. They weren't doing it anymore. It was 10 years before Carol Burnett brought the review format back to television. So there was nothing there were horses and guns then. A lot of westerns were done, and situation comedies prevailed. Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, and somebody sent me some a script of a situation comedy, and it wasn't very good, and then I turned it down, and my wife said, why didn't you write one? And I had never written a situation comedy, and I'd never written anything, but I think I had written Into Laughing, a novel by then, I'm not sure. Anyway, so I wrote this pilot based on my life in New Rochelle, and I remember riding on the highway going home to New Rochelle and saying, what piece of ground do I stand on that nobody else stands on? And I said, well, I live in New Rochelle, I work in New York, I'll write about that. And that's how the Dick Van Dyke Show was born. Actually, it was Head of the Family was born. I wrote the pilot, and it was picked up by a guy named Peter Lawford, who wanted to be a producer. And I was in Fire Island at the time, and I said, hey, if I do a pilot, I better have a Bible of scripts ready for other writers to write about. So on that summer in Fire Island, I wrote 13 episodes of Head of the Family, and I got to do the pilot, a one-camera show, no audience, which we played it for an audience, captured their laughs, and went on the air. It was okay. I did it with Barbara Britton and Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles, two wonderful actors, but I was just fair in it, and it didn't sell. We tested it. It went on once and didn't. And I was very disenchanted with it as well. That's my best shot for television. And at that time, I started to write movies. I started writing a thing called The Thrill of It All. Larry Gelbart and I had an idea, and I wrote a script called The Thrill of It All. And I was involved with that. And Sheldon Leonard, who had read these 13 scripts that my agent was dying to somebody to use, he called me in and he said, these are good, I think we could do a show with them. And I said, I remember saying, Sheldon, I don't want to fail with the same material twice. And he said, this is a good impression of him, by the way, you won't fail, we'll get a better actor to play you. And he suggested Dick Van Dyke, and the rest is history.
No, but Dick Van Dyke, he's a guy whose his comedy is very physical. He's really tied into his torso and how he moves. He's like a silent comedian. I remember, in fact, when he had a series later, he always had a silent sequence in that.
Well, you know, I did a movie with him called The Comic, which was maybe the best acting you'll ever see. Dick Van Dyke is a consummate artist. He's not only an actor, a dancer, a singer, a banjo player. He can do anything. He really can do anything. He's an extraordinary talent. And when he did the Dick Van Dyke Show, his glibness, I mean, his ability to learn a line and turn it into something gold was inspirational for me. I love writing for Dick. And to this day, he is the single most talented human being I've ever worked with. Well, Mel Brooks, as far as funny, there's nobody funnier in the whole world than Mel Brooks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's funny. And you're funny.
I'm not too bad.
We're chatting with Carl Reiner. His latest book is Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Like, I was watching the episode that you put the script in, sorry, The Attempted Marriage, and there's so much physical stuff that Dick Van Dyke does. How would that have been different? I mean, when you were, did you take those 13 scripts and rework them entirely for the cast that you had?
Oh, yes. Well, the original 13 scripts were one-camera shows, and I had to write them for three cameras, which means that we were going to do it in sequence for an audience. The other one was done in pieces, and it was a revelation because it was so wonderful. We to hear the audience laughter, capture their laughter, and not add any laughter. As a matter of fact, our laugh trap was captured by a guy named Charlie Douglas, who used to work on our show when we sort of cut off a scene abruptly. There would be a cutoff of a laugh. You'd ha, and it would stop. He would trickle it off with a ha, ha, and that's all he did for us. But he loved our laugh track so much that he put it in his machine, and he used it on other one-camera shows so that our laugh was heard. As a matter of fact, I wrote about it, Barbara Vane, who later became an actor on our show and became, you know, Mission Impossible. She was Cinnamon Carter. She was brilliant. She was used to come to all our earlier shows and laugh out loud. So I used to tell people that Barbara Vane is laughing on shows. You'll hear her laughing on shows she's never seen because she was all these other shows.
So when we're watching Get Smart, we're really hearing the laugh track from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yes.
You know, you have this marvelous ear for dialogue. You know, the dialogue sounds so natural. When I was reading it on the page, it was hard to believe that anybody had written it because it seems to flow out of the actors so naturally.
I know. That was the trick of it. I said, one of the things I assiduously did was not use any slang, so the fact that I knew this, we were doing something very special. I knew it would last. And look, we're still playing it on television every night because it sounds human. And I said, only write about who you are and what you are. I mean, we writers are no different than the audience. We feel the same. We get angry. We get jealous. We do all the things that everybody does. So just write about yourself and you'll be touching into everybody else's lives.
Do you think a lot about what makes something funny? I mean, you don't have a lot of, there's not a lot of jokes per se in Van Dyke Show.
No, the jokes are, actually, we had a guy, the human joke machine was Maury Amston. Anytime we needed a real joke, he would come up with it. He was called the human joke machine, and he had a nightclub on Broadway where he used to get up and you throw him a subject. You throw jokes at, back on the subject. So no, but I wrote wittily, but not with jokes. I couldn't write jokes.
In your original pilot, the Head of the Family pilot, the character that Maury Amsterdam eventually played was a much younger guy.
Yes, because I was thinking of Mel Brooks. He was in the writers' room of the show of shows. Mel Brooks was the young writer, the youngest of the bunch. So I wanted to have a young writer, but then when Rosemary was the first one I cast, and she said the natural for this would be Maury Amsterdam. And I thought he was too old, but then when I thought of getting him, where I'd seen on, you know, in New York, on Broadway, I said that would be a plus, and so I forgot the fact that I needed a young guy there. I'd rather have an old guy who really, he really delivered for us.
The idea of Pickles, that's okay. Pickles is my favorite name, but to have a wife named Pickles.
Yeah, it was an invention I had. That I didn't have enough room to see her, so we wrote about her. He talked about her a lot. And when we finally did see her, we found a very good actress to play her, Joan London.
When you finally sold the Dick Van Dyke Show, you had to move to California, or were you already in California?
I think by that time I was in California. But I didn't go back. That's right. I didn't go back. I came out to do the Dinah Shore show, a television show that I wrote, and every other week I was on it as a performer. As a matter of fact, that was my favorite calling card credit. It was written by Charles Isaacs and Carl Reiner. Every week you saw that credit. And when I was on the show, it said, usually I would have a special guest. Our special guest was Yves Montand that week, and I was billed as, and you're not so special guest, Carl Reiner. Not so special guest. I loved that.
So you moved your family from New Rochelle, California.
Yeah, they were, my children were 12 and 14 at the time.
Was that a traumatic move, or were you ready
for it? It was, because they had moved from the Bronx to New Rochelle. That was the first move, and we lived there for about 5 years, and they had to move again and get new friends. And when you're 12 years old, you have really good friends, and they had to find new friends out here, and they did, but it was not easy for them.
What about for you and your wife?
Well, it wasn't for us, because we mainly wanted to make our kids happy. But very quickly, they melded in here. Then we had a child out here, and once you have a child in a certain place, then you have put a foot down, you planted your flag, And
around the time of the Dick Van Dyke Show, I just so happens the other day I was watching TV, and I was watching the Judy Garland Show.
Yes.
And you were a guest. You were sitting with Judy Garland.
Yeah, I love, dude. I ever love her. I tweeted this once, that she is the single most talented human being I've ever worked with, saw, or enjoyed. She just could, there's nothing about her that wasn't perfect. She was a perfect performer. I remember two things. I don't know if I did it on the show, but I know I did it maybe in the dressing room, but I said, we talked about being the same age. I think on the show she said, in the dressing room she says, we were both 37 at the time. She says, isn't this a shitty age? I said, what are you talking about? She says, well, 38 is a nice round number. You're getting close to 40, which isn't one everyone wants to reach. But it's and then I said, it's like the in-between age when you sang a song, I'm just Mr. In-Between, when she was in love with Clark Gable or somebody, yeah, and sang to his picture. I said, you're doing it again. Anyway, but I told her, I said, when you were 13, you sang a thing called Balboa in a movie. I forgot the name of the movie. And I fell in love with you. I was 13. I said, that's the cutest person I've ever seen. And I said, it remained thus. I said, I've never not loved you. And she's too bad we couldn't have met then.
It was really a gem to see you.
No, I think one of the shows, she had two shows. One of them, she says, talk with celebrities. I said, I don't really belong here. She's why not? I said, well, I'm not really a celebrity. She said, you are. And she tried to convince me I was. I said, no, I go in the street, nobody wants to kiss me or, like Sinatra, don't chase after me. And I try to downplay myself, and she tried to convince me I was a celebrity.
Well, you've known a lot of legendary performers in your career, including Mark Twain, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, in my book, I think that's the funniest thing I have. One of the funniest things. When you have a book, you always look for some important person like Rochefoucauld or Oscar Wilde to put in at the beginning, a little quote of theirs. And so I quoted this wonderful quote. It says here, after 4 hours at the wheel of the Mississippi paddle boat transporting folks to their homes, I am afforded no greater pleasure than retiring to my stateroom, turning on my new RCA Victor 7-inch television set, and watching Carl Reiner's hilarious The Dick Van Dyke Show, Mark Twain. And then I have a picture, actually, that was a set we had, a 7-inch set, and I have a picture of it on the other side.
That was very nice of Mark Twain to come back from the dead and write you a blurb on you.
Yeah, well, Mark Twain is my favorite writer in the whole world ever. As a matter of fact, as Huckleberry Finn, it's been said that the novel didn't exist before that was the definitive novel, American novel. Hmm. And after that, everybody came and said, oh, yeah, that's how you do it.
Talking with Carl Reiner, whose books include God Bless You is for Both Sneezing and Farting. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We were talking earlier about what makes things funny. Do you think you learned from Mark Twain or other writers how to craft humor?
I think I learned that from two things have to happen. There's a funny bone born in some people that is just lays there and doesn't do anything unless there's an outside influence, and usually your conditioning is your family, your mother, your father. And my mother and father loved comedians, and they used to take me to the movies when I was kids. We always went on a Saturday, and I remember seeing the Marx Brothers, the Ritz Brothers, and Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, of course, and laughing was a priority. And then we'd listen to the radio and listen to the Jack Benny Show, the Fred Allen Show, the Joe Penna Show, anything that had comedy in it. And that's where you hone your thing. It's your background And if you have a funny bone, it develops.
You had a lot of radio actors or kind of actors from that era that you found parts for on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Well, yeah, there was one season where I decided I was going to do a tribute to the radio actors. And that was a wonderful time on the set because I had three of them. You know, it's funny. When I was 13 years old, I listened to a radio program called the Rudy Valley Show. And on it, he said he was going to have an impersonator. I loved impersonators. And then on comes this impersonator. His name is Richard Hyden, impersonating a guy named Edwin Karp. And he says, "I don't impersonate people. I impersonate fish. I would like to do for you now." This is radio. I'm listening to this when I'm 13. "I would like to do now the sound of the yellow mountain trout. He makes a sound so inaudible to the human ear that you can't hear it. Listen carefully." And then for 1 minute, there was no sound. And I'm laughing hysterically. I'm 13. I never forgot that. And when I got to be an adult and I'm doing the Van Dyke Show, I said, I've got to recreate that moment. And I had Richard Hyden, and there's a picture in the book of Richard Hyden with his mouth agape, making no sound, the sound of the yellow mountain trout. Oh, you just no sound. But having Richard on the show and doing his wonderful poems, I mean, it was the best week of my life.
It's a wonderful show, and there's so many episodes. You know, nowadays they only do about 24 episodes a season or something, or 23, or 13.
We did 35 to 37 episodes a season. We have 158 in all, and, you know, it's funny because the first couple of years I was writing by myself for about 3 years, and I was, you know, I laugh today when I see it. We did a show that was 28 and a half minutes long and 15 seconds for a perfect public service announcement. I was always fighting for 5-10 seconds to do a tag, and you know, to get my whole show in beginning, middle, and end and tag. And today, I'm looking at the shows, and they're down from 27, 8 minutes to 20 minutes. They're down from 22. This was because I thank Ronald Reagan for it. He said, no, the airwaves belong to anybody who wants to advertise. Instead of what Herbert Hoover said, that belongs to the people. Ronald Reagan gave it to the advertisers so that 28-minute shows went down to 20 minutes. Now you can see Viagra and Cheese Whiz all in the same 10 seconds. You can see one after another, one after another. If you like commercials, it's for you. But I'm very, very upset about that part of the year. What were we talking about right before that? I wanted to say something else.
Oh, we were talking about the actors that you had on the show.
Yes, anytime we had a chance to use a wonderful actor, I remember on the show when I did the tribute to the radio actors, we had Burt Gordon, the Mad Russian.
Oh, yeah.
And Arlene Harris, the Chatterbox. Yeah. Oh, I always was so happy when we got there was one show called I'm No Henry Walden, and we got a famous actor from Orson Welles's theater, Everett Sloan, to play, and I was thrilled. I was almost ashamed to ask him. I said, and he was so thrilled to do it, and he was so nice about it. And it was so sad because he committed suicide at 57 because he lost his memory and his sight, and he figured it doesn't pay to hang around anymore. But he did the show a few years before that, and I was so sad to read about that.
He was a fine actor.
He was, really.
I want to ask you just about the directors on the show. John Rich, who I guess was the first director of the...
He was the first director, and he set the show on it. He had done a lot of three-camera shows. He was like the guy to go to anybody who wants to do a three-camera show. And he did so well for us that we kept him on for the first, I don't know, five dozen shows. And then one of our actors, Jerry Helper, wanted to become a director, and luckily he was on all those shows, and he carefully monitored what John had done, and Jerry even did more shows than John, ultimately. So we had wonderful direction always.
And I associated John Rich with All in the Family.
Yes, right.
He did many seasons, if not all of the seasons, of All in the Family.
Right.
You know, it's a great show, and I know you said that you knew you were doing something special, that it would last. But did you ever think, wow, you know, now you can get them all on Blu-ray. They look better than they ever looked.
I know. You know, somebody colored Lucy's show, and they sent to me a couple of cells of our show colored. Boy, it really looks great in color. But at the time we decided not to go in color because it would cost $67,000 or whatever it was a show, and it wouldn't put us in the red. So we said leave me in black and white. But it seems to be doing very well in black and white.
I particularly like black and white. What can I say? I think black and white looks great.
I do too. And when I see old movies in black and white, as a matter of fact, this week I just taped a coming movie, Jeanette Marie Chevalier in The Merry Widow.
Oh, I love that. That's an Ernst Lubitsch picture, I believe.
Oh, Ernst Lubitsch was the man. Boy, was he great.
Yeah. I love those. There's something weird about those Chevalier, Jeanette MacDonald movies. Chevalier is kind of a strange comedian.
He was a strange cat. I saw him on Broadway. He was very charming, but he was a strange human being. He was our entree to the French, lover. He was the only one doing movies in America from France at that time.
He did a good French accent.
Oh, yes.
Not as good as yours, but his was okay.
In the Army, they sent me to Georgetown University to learn to be a French interpreter. So I learned French, and they sent me to Hawaii, where they speak very little French.
Now, so you don't, you actually speak French? I thought you just fake
speak. Oh, no, je peux parler français. I can speak French, but I can also double talk in French. But the master double talker was Sid Caesar. He could double talk in any language. It was extraordinary. It was like a violinist playing. He was so good at it.
Carl Reiner, his latest book is called Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. It's a fabulous book. It was the greatest sitcom of all time. And Carl Reiner, it's been such a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for allowing me to talk about it, because I'm so proud of it, and I want to get into people's hands, through your mouth, through people's hands.
Well, I'll do my best for you.
Okay.
I made your last book a bestseller, didn't I?
You absolutely did. I will come to you with my next one, which is called Me at 93, which I'm working on right now.
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait. I'm going to put it on my shelf right next to God Bless You is for Both Sneezing and Farting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, that one is coming out now with illustrations in about 6 months. James Bennett is putting out, is doing the final touches on the colored illustrations, and it's going to be a winner. By the way, at the very beginning, I added this to the book. Yeah, it's called You Say God Bless You for Sneezing and Farting. And I checked this out on Google. Mine is not the first fart book. There were 25 books on farting. The first one was written in 1723 or 1774, something like 1730, by Benjamin Franklin. I bought it. I paid $15 for it. It's a perfect little book. It's called Fart Proudly, and there's a picture of Benjamin Franklin on the cover. Since then, they found out that repressing a fart is very unhealthy for your system, because you're getting rid of gases that shouldn't be festering there, and if you keep them, you're not doing your system well. So farting is healthy.
Fart proudly, said Benjamin Franklin.
Okay.
Oh, Carl Reiner, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to speak to you again, and I look forward to getting a chance to speak to you next time.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Carl Reiner. His latest book is called Why and When the Dick Van Dyke Show Was Born. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.